Allora, ti ci deve avere più.
The Honourable Emperor Seni has given notice he will be late. The Honourable Dexter and Honourable Smutson Konyama will not be attending. The Honourable Masasia is away attending to a matter at his house. That some criminals broke into his house. The Honourable Santo is presently doing oversight work with public enterprises. The Honourable Van Wyk is with the Portfolio Committee on Police. I've also had the Honourable Kutsi and the Honourable Stibber who have apologized that they also have commitments in their constituency. The Honourable Wutsi's wife is not well. He's had to travel home. Are there any other apologies, Honourable Members? Honourable Members, I know that yesterday the session in the House was quite extensive. I did see the Honourable Members bleed in the House, and it was very difficult times, particularly that the electronic voting system broke down. I got a number of members after the session who were suffering from severe stress. I keep that in mind as we proceed today. Particularly also because it's a Friday and a lot of those members that are not accustomed to the Western Cape's weather have also complained. So the lack of attendance, Honourable Members, I think has been justified not because of the weather, but it seems circumstances are caught up with a number of members of a committee. And let it not be said that because the life of the committee has been extended that members have now taken advantage of that. That's certainly not the impression I have gotten from the apologies that I have received. The Honourable Members, I take it, are now aware that yesterday in the House a resolution was passed and the committee is now to report to the House on the 23rd of September. The previous deadline was the 24th of June, and we were able to avoid any inconvenience such as those that we had suffered in the past. So, Honourable Members, we are here today to continue our work. During the period that we have not met, a document was circulated. You will recall that when we were here the last time, the issue that we were busy with was the review panel. The ANC had presented a document, and subsequently, during the week, a document was circulated, a combined document from the opposition parties, in which they set up their particular proposal to the independent classification review oversight panel, which had originally been proposed by the ANC. Before we get there, there's also now the question of redrafting our program. So those would be the two matters that we would have to deal with, redrafting of our program, and then in terms of the work to continue the discussion on the proposal that has been submitted by the opposition parties on the review panel. Honourable Members. Honourable Landers, Chair. Chairperson, yes, we've received from the Honourable Steve Swart, and we note that this was a joint effort, and we appreciate that. We've had a careful look at the document, and we wondered if this morning couldn't be utilized for someone from the opposition party to take us through the document, and if there's matters that must be clarified, then so be it. We would want an opportunity to further engage with the document. So, you know, it's not finalized and closed today, so I think that must be made clear. It's part of our ongoing engagement with the bill. So I would ask if we could do that, Chairperson. The Honourable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and we are prepared to briefly go through the document with your leave, Chairperson, and then we can discuss a way forward. We want to agree that it's not cast in stone by any means. There are areas that we'd like to further explore with the majority party, but it might be useful for us to briefly go through the document together with the ANC's document and just indicate where there are differences, and then invite questions for clarity, and then we can discuss the program forward. Thank you, Chair.
Are you leading that delegation, Honourable Swart?
If I may, with your leave, Chairperson.
No, you need leave of your partners, your alliance partners, if they are. You speak on their behalf. Then so let it be. Proceed, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, just to emphasise that the document is a joint submission by the DA, IFP and the ACDP, and I appreciate the inputs from my colleagues, and Mr. Ambrosini will be joining us a bit later, and I'm sure we might finish before he gets here, but maybe he'd like to add something. But again, just to emphasise that the document is not cast in stone, it's our suggestions, and I fully appreciate the majority party having the need for time to consider the implications and to look into the differences between our suggestions and those from the majority party. So if I may just take you briefly through the document and just point out where there are differences. Firstly, we agree with the proposal of an independent review panel as proposed by the ANC, but we would like to add the words oversight panel to include the whole concept of oversight. The functions then, as we set out in 22.1, which is a new A, where we propose that the panel will review and oversee the implementation of this Act, including compliance with the classification criteria contemplated in Section 15. There's a slight typographical error there. It's either 15 or 13, depending on the words, on the numbering. So it would, at this stage, probably section clause 15 is probably the better term there. So it's not only review, it is also oversee the implementation of the Act. That's a new A. Under B, the ANC's proposal was to receive all reports of 10-year reviews on the status of all classified information conducted by organs of state, and we'd suggest to add there the phrase, including bulk classification or declassification prescribed by the minister. So that is an additional insertion there that we'd suggest. We'd also suggest a new C, receive notification of any information having been classified or declassified as soon as or soon after such information is so classified or declassified. That is our new proposal C. There's a typographical error. The next subclause should read D, and that would be the ANC's previous C, which is exactly the same as the ANC's proposal. The ANC's D, our proposal for R, which would become E, is just to add the inclusion of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development when this panel reports its findings. And clearly that's a new concept that we'd like to further elaborate on, and we'd ask the majority party to consider the inclusion of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development for a variety of reasons, the first one being that the Portfolio Committee, many of us serve on that Portfolio Committee as well, but its main task is to look at constitutional development, at compliance with the Constitution, and there are many constitutional aspects that have been raised, concerns that have been raised as we are going through this legislation, and we believe that it would serve a good purpose, a useful purpose, a very important purpose, that the findings of this panel should not only be reported to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, but also the Portfolio Committee on Justice, and we believe they've got a very important role to play in this whole process. Also bearing in mind that the Minister of Justice is the minister in the Cabinet that is that deals with all access to information, with PIA, the Human Rights Commission, which is also very involved in PIA access to information, accounts to the Justice Portfolio Committee, and there's a good synergy there that I think is very useful to consider. The Minister of Intelligence and the Minister of Justice both serve on the same cluster, which is also very important, and as we go along further to see the role that the Portfolio Committee on Justice can play. The Justice Committee holds open meetings. It doesn't have the similar concerns of the Intelligence Committee that has to have closed meetings. When it comes to looking at suitable candidates for this panel, we believe the Justice Committee can also play a very important role in that regard. So those are our brief reasons why we would consider the involvement of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development. Our new E is just to submit an annual report on its activities to Parliament, which I think is important. But as regard to what occurred in the Justice Committee this last week with the Sexual Offences Bill, where there was a similar requirement for annual reports, regrettably those reports were not furnished in that particular context, but it is a very important to assist us in oversight that we have such annual reports. So we would suggest that is an insertion as well. 22 sub 2 is very similar to the ANC's proposals, the only difference being under D, where we would suggest the insertion as well, where one considers the rules which the panel can make relating to random sampling, is what we suggest the word in. D, random sampling methods to be employed in reviewing compliance under section 22.1A. 22.1A is a reference to the 22.1A of this document. And that is, this panel must review and oversee the implementation of this act, including compliance with classification criteria. So 22.1A will refer to random sampling methods to be employed in reviewing compliance under A. Chairperson, then as far as 23 is concerned, our clause 23, members of the panel, we've taken the ANC document and we've just further elaborated on that. Under 22.1, where the ANC 1A suggested 5 members, we've said we agree 5 members, and then we've added in that they should be appointed for a non-renewable term of 5 years. On the basis of the recommendation of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development, those words should be inserted there, of the National Assembly, approved by the National Assembly after suitable candidates nominated by the public have been interviewed in a public process. And that would be the process of nomination where, as you recall, I indicated that it is very important that we need a transparent process to appoint credible and independent persons who will have the required authority and, as I indicated earlier, the role that the Justice Portfolio Committee, meeting in open, and for the reasons I've already given, why they can play a very important role in the appointment process of the members of this panel. Secondly, 23 sub 2, the ANC, we've added to the clause that the ANC suggested that the members of the panel must comprise persons appointed on the basis of their knowledge. We've suggested further criteria relating to experience and involvement pertaining to access to information. We believe this is a very crucial aspect that should be included there. Constitutional law, and bear in mind this bill concerns national security, so we are happy to include that as well. And then we've got an alternative there that one can look at with suitable qualification or experience in access to information law, practice of human rights law, and must have an understanding of national security and related matters. In that way, we wish to balance the members of this panel to have the required knowledge of access to information, constitutional law, as well as national security. So those are aspects that one can look at as various formulation as to which criteria particularly are required for those members of the panel. Sub 3, Chairperson, is basically the standard, a number of standard clauses which I've drafted, add into what the majority party has suggested. The majority parties A, B, and C remain, except for C, where we can have a debate as to the amount of work that these panel members will be required to perform and whether they would be required to perform this in a full-time or a part-time capacity, whether some should be full-time, some should be part-time. So again, under C, we are not, that suggestion of full-time is not cast in stone. Obviously, there are cost implications there, and we'd like to further engage on debate that issue as to whether the members of the panel should be full-time or part-time, obviously bearing the financial considerations that such full-time appointments would require. 3E are your standard clauses that such members should at no time be or become unrehabilitated insolvents, be or have been judicially declared of unsound mind, suffer an infirmity of mind or body preventing him or her from being able to properly discharge his or her duties, be convicted of a final conviction or sentence, be or become a political office bearer, or be or have been removed from an office of trust on account of misconduct involving theft and fraud. Those are standard clauses that we can discuss. If one wants to add to them, we can further engage on that aspect. If a member of the panel will cease to be a member on resignation, on removal on grounds of misconduct, incompetence or incapacity after finding to that effect by the Portfolio Committee on Justice, bearing in mind that in our recommendation that committee will appoint such members of the panel. 3, if he or she fails to attend 2 consecutive meetings of the panel unless an apology has been accepted, or 4, if he or she becomes disqualified in terms of this act. And then G is a clause relating to payment of remuneration and benefits as determined by the Minister after consultation with the Director General and with the approval of the Minister of Finance. 4 and 5 are standard clauses relating to vacancies that should be filled in terms of 23.1, and 5 is the administrative work connected with the performance of the functions of the panel shall be performed by officers of the department designated by the DG for that purpose. And those are our submissions. Chair, if you'd like us to further elaborate on any of the aspects. Might I just add that whilst I was drafting this, I found an interesting clause in the NPA's annual report, which shows that they do actually vetting as well. The whole aspect of vetting of such panel members is something that we obviously need to discuss. But in terms of the annual report, there's a report that indicates that their security and risk management section had 308 files for vetting applications in different levels, which were received by them and registered in their subcomponent of vetting, and that their own unit conducted vetting fieldwork for 45 top secret and 140 confidential vetting, which is quite interesting. They also worked on a further 150 clearance certificates which were received from the NIA. So there seems to be, in the justice umbrella, the capacity for vetting and for dealing with matters of top secret and of a confidential nature. And that is another reason why we've suggested that the Portfolio Committee, to whom the NPA and the Department of Justice accounts, can play a very significant role in this whole appointment process. Thank you, Chair. you want to add?
If you will allow me to add a comment, but then just to, I want to point to what we would further have to decide upon. We've suggested in 22.1a that when this panel reviews and oversees the implementation of the Act, which gives it now the job of looking after all of the implementation of the Act, we've included specifically that it should keep an eye on compliance with the classification criteria contemplated in Section 15. That is the clause which we have already rewritten, and we are just about 99% in agreement. It's a good piece of work. We set quite strict criteria for classification, both in respect of the probability and the gravity. Now, I can think of a few things better to do to instill confidence in the public that our classification regime will not be abused than creating this panel which you have suggested, the ANC. In addition, one would have to look at the appeal mechanism. But now, we need to think quite carefully about how this panel goes to work. We've said that it should specifically keep an eye on compliance with those classification criteria. If you then ask yourself, how will they be doing this thing, our answer is that it must be done by way of random sampling, and therefore we have built into the section on the making of rules for the panel in concurrence with the minister that they must set the random sampling methods to be employed in reviewing compliance. What we haven't done so far is to address the further questions that arise, Chair, and I think it's important just to mention them at this point. Now, what do we expect the panel to do when, upon random sampling, it finds instances of non-compliance? Do we mean by review that it will automatically set aside that particular classification after consideration, perhaps, of the reasons given for the classification? Are we going to write into this law that every decision on classification must have written reasons? We need to think about that. Or is it the case that if on random sampling you find instances of non-compliance, you start sampling broader, but Mr. Mania must help us on how random sampling works, would you then sample broader? Would you set aside the classifications? Would you require of that particular department new classification with written reasons maybe for the first time? So we need to be clear in our minds, I think, what happens when they find the non-compliance. Other examples of instances of non-compliance could be under the 10-year reviews, the clause 22 10-year reviews. Those 10-year reviews require that the criteria for continued classification are brought to bear, and those are stricter as they stand at the moment than the criteria for classification. So what happens if it is found, A, that a 10-year review was not done, something needs to happen after that, or that it was not done completely? B, what happens if it is found that in the 10-year review, the reclassification of documents did not complete, because some will be declassified, that in the reclassification, the criteria for continued classification were not adhered to? Once again, does the panel set aside? Does it substitute its judgment under our administrative justice clause, which we all need to go and have another look at, and the PADJA? Do they set aside necessarily? Do they necessarily perform an appeal function right here? So I think that there are further questions do arise, but the clause we've given you, which slightly expands upon yours, is tight and elegant. And it wouldn't need much more by way of sub-clauses to address the issues I've just raised. But we need to decide what it is we want. I think, Chair, that's all for now.
Honourable members, can I ask the key question, which I asked at the last meeting? Is it your view that these members should be vetted and that they should have the necessary clearance?
Chair, previously we indicated that we do not believe that those members should be vetted. Obviously, it's an issue which we'll further engage with you on. I think that having seen now that there is vetting done by other organs, and I need to find out how that fits into the old intelligence structure, one might re-look at that, but it's not an issue that we have finally considered amongst ourselves. But I do recall that we indicated that there should not be vetting, but I think it, as all issues are, it is an issue which we need to continue to debate upon.
I would think, and our positions may not always be the same, I would think that an independent panel, and this is now in its form and function is a genuinely independent panel, should precisely not be subject to vetting. But I'm willing to listen to argument, but one is hopefully going to appoint people who already are people of standing in this society and knowledge, and it would seem to me to be the wrong thing to vet them. Mr. Mania may have another view.
Are there three views in this alliance of yours?
Maybe we can, there are different levels of vetting, it appears, and done by different organizations, and just reading this vetting that is done on the NPA, one has various types of vetting, and the NPA seems to have done vetting for top secret clearances without the NIA involvement, and which one presumes that I might be incorrect, but according to this, so it depends, and pre-employment screenings have also been done. So one might not want to call it vetting at the end of the day. One might want to just have a pre-employment screening. But let's not get stuck in that. As again, we've said, it's not an issue which is cast in stone. I agree that because it's an independent panel, there is maybe an objection to a full vetting proposal or process. But I also appreciate that such members of the panel will be dealing with national security issues. So we've got to strike the correct balance. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Landers, you're going to tell us about the vetting now.
No, Chair, we appreciate what has been placed before us. I believe it takes us a long way. We do make the point that we would like to go away and think about some of the proposals placed before us, some of which are very good. Say right at the outset. The points raised.
You like the Justice Board?
No, Chair. I'm speaking also as a former member of the JSCI, Chairperson. So Chairperson, the issues raised by Dean Smuts as well as Steve Swart about non-compliance is a matter we have to give serious consideration to, because I recall it was a question raised by, I think, Dr. Ambrosini. And he said, well, what happens when there's non-compliance? And we haven't addressed that in the bill. So we would have to apply our minds to that. I'm glad that there's a procedure for both the appointment and removal of panel members, because that was one of my personal concerns. You can't just appoint people and not have a removal process. There has to be that. With regard to adult services, a matter open for discussion. The vetting, we believe they should be vetted. We don't believe you can have people considering matters of top secret classification, and they are just ordinary people who have not been vetted. Mr. Swart correctly points to members of the NPA who have been vetted. The pre-screening is a procedure put in place by NIA. And what it does is it helps speed up the process. It's basic information, your name, full name, your ID number, place of residence, date of birth, qualifications, education qualifications, stuff like that. Stuff which is already on record, wherever you may be. That's the pre-screening stuff. So that when the vetting actually takes place, the person doing the vetting knows who you are. Not meeting you for the first time and then must ask you, can you please spell your surname for me and stuff like that. So that's all it intended to do. And all the departments of state are required to do that, particularly with people at that senior level who must be screened and vetted. So it's nothing new. Okay, we assumed that you knew that the people in the NPA were being vetted. So we were quite surprised when you raised these concerns. But all right, we understand the motivation behind it.
Mr. Smile looks very amused. Thinks I'm ignorant. May I ask the Honourable Lander through you, Chair? The remarks you just made upon pre-screening and vetting, how would they relate, for example, to your standards of ineligibility in 23.3, the grounds upon which people are excluded? And it amuses me that the way Steve Swart has drafted this, which is very elegant, by the way, the way he's juxtaposed the classic kinds of ineligibility criteria being you can't become a member of the panel if you are mad, bankrupt, imprisoned without the option of a fine, or a politician. your juxtaposition most unusual. No, we don't have politicians, but it is just the position as a mad banker, politician. Now, all these, would your pre-screening people, would they be looking precisely, checking up whether a candidate doesn't, right? Because we frequently have the situation, of course, in the very many appointment committees we have in this parliament for independent bodies. We frequently have the situation where we have to go and scratch around and check up on whether a person's CV is bona fide, for example, right?
Chair, you see, it just helps speed up the process, you know, when all this information, for example, if I'm assuming, thinking ahead, that an advert is placed calling for submissions of names of people, that in the advert it would say, for example, you must be prepared that you're going to be vetted. So, you know, straight away that, well, if you have some kind of objection to being vetted, in the same way that some people have religious objections to other stuff, then fine, you that's it. You say, sorry, not for me, and that's it. But yes, clearly, this is all the stuff that will be involved in the pre-screening. Are you a citizen of the Republic? Your ID document should confirm that. Being committed to the purposes and principles, well, that's something that will take place in the interview. Be available full-time, well, that's something we're still going to discuss. Are these people full-time or part-time? And, well, the rest is what's important. Some people have a tendency of hiding that stuff, that I'm an unrehabilitated insolvent, that I'm of unsound mind. Well, that's a difficult one. if you think about it. Sure, sure. But then, you know, one person's unsound mind is another person's perfectly sane, you know.
the Honourable... Okay, stop that conversation now, please. Can we have the Honourable Fichel now?
I'm sorry, Chair. You know, there's another system that is done for people who are making applications for work. Yeah, that they are done screening, especially on their CVs, to prove whether that is a genuine CV or whether it's forged CV or sort of or that nature. And it's done also similar to vetting, something similar to vetting.
Honourable members, on the question of vetting, allow me to get you to think. Are you wanting to talk, Honourable Member? We are assuming now, for the purposes of this discussion, that you have a box full of secrets that have been properly they've been gone through the process and people have properly classified them. You would, in that box of secrets,
there would be some very serious secrets, particularly the ones that you need to prevent from disclosure. And so the question of who should be seeing the secret become very important, particularly to the intelligence community. Who should be seeing the secrets? You are now trying to introduce a review panel of persons who on paper merely have to be, they don't have to be insolvent, and they must appear to be sane and some other qualifications. And on that basis, you say that they are okay. On the other hand, where the documents are being classified, you expect those people to be vetted, and seriously vetted too, because they are going to be dealing with the secrets of the country that we all want to be protected. On this side of your argument, you say those people don't necessarily have to be vetted. It seems an unbalanced contradiction. And so I just ask you to look at that a little bit more carefully. You cannot have people, for whatever reason, that are not properly vetted, looking at these very, very serious secrets. Let's look at the ones that are really secret. Forget the ones that you want to be exposed and you want the panel really to get and throw them out. They should never have been. But look at the ones that should. You really wouldn't want some undercover agent to end up on this panel. And it's not very difficult having a look at these things. So it's very, very important. I would imagine, from my point of view, that these people go through the proper screening. You would know that in order to get a top secret clearance, you have to go through a polygraph test. And you have to go through extensive interviews. There's various processes. Now, who does the screening and who does the vetting? It's not important. NIA is responsible for vetting as it is. There are institutions like the police that are doing their own vetting. There are the defense force, that defense intelligence, that do their own vetting. But ultimately, NIA are the responsible persons in terms of the legislation for dealing and for seeing that those that should be vetted in the public sector are properly vetted. The fact that the prosecuting authority are also doing vetting, we had, you know, from the Scorpions, there was problems with the Scorpions because at one time we weren't sure whether they were dealing with intelligence, because if they were, they needed to be vetted, and if they weren't, then the vetting wasn't a process, wasn't a problem, but they fluctuated between those two particular positions. At one stage they were saying they were not gathering intelligence, on the other hand, they were saying that they did, and that the legislation did allow them. But the question of vetting became a serious problem within that institution because they were vetting themselves. So I do ask you, Honourable Members, to consider, it appears to be more than a paradox, it appears to be a contradiction, where you're wanting your people, and this is on your insistence, that those that are responsible for classification be a high-ranking official, because you look at that integrity there, and he's going to have to be vetted. But on this side, when you start reviewing, you're not calling for the same very strict conditions that you are asking for on the other side. Honourable Mania?
Chair, obviously this is a debate that that the committee are going to have to engage in. But can I ask you, the judge responsible for reviewing and then either authorizing or denying warrants for interception of telephones, is that judge vetted? And if so, why not?
To my knowledge, he's not vetted. And to my knowledge, he's got a very limited function. He does not necessarily deal with classified
information in the sense of documents. It deals with applications, and in the applications, the law enforcement agencies have to comply with the requirements of the Act in order to convince him that an order needs to be granted. But I'm not going to make out a case for the judge. Yes, on what I've said on this, and then I'll get to you, Honourable Swan.
You see, when an application is made to the RICA judge, what we call the directing judge, that's done by a sworn affidavit. Firstly, it's by sworn affidavit. The judge has the authority to call in the person making the application and ask him some very pertinent questions. And based on the sworn affidavit and answers provided to the judge's questions, the judge decides whether to grant the direction or to refuse it. Bear in mind that this could end up in a court of law. So the persons making the applications are all mindful of this. That if ever the matter comes to a court of law, he may be required to stand up in court and justify what he told the judge. So in the case of, let's say, the Hawks or members of crime intelligence, they will be mindful of that. In as far as NIA is concerned, their applications are not crime or criminally based. Theirs are ongoing. But even in their case, they would be very careful to ensure that the judge is not given top secret information. But still, the judge would require certain very pertinent answers to a lot of questions he or she may have. So the functions are not quite the same. What we are asking for here is a review panel. Judge, the RICA judge, receives applications for the law enforcement agencies to intercept your communications and mine, depending on whether we are involved in criminal activities.
The Honourable Swartz and then the Honourable Mania.
I do appreciate what you said and your concerns, and it is something that we will seriously consider. But I would like to just test it a little bit, but firstly to make the point that we might not need to reach finality on this issue now, because again we need to take the whole bill as a whole context. Once we've reached in different stages, like we've improved the threshold, now we're looking at an independent panel, and you quite correctly point out that possible contradiction. That's why we need to look at the whole bill in its context. Should we meet each other on the issue of the involvement of the Justice Committee, for example, there could be a mechanism there because I appreciate concerns about vetting, but I want to, and so one could consider the different levels. I'm afraid I don't know. The reason I raised the NPA issue, I'm fully aware that they are vetted, but in their context, they do it themselves to a certain degree. So that's why I raised it as a possibility that there seems to be in-house abilities in the justice cluster as well. I might be incorrect. Obviously, NIA does play a role, but what we would not like to see is candidates that we believe are eminently suitable for their background of PIA, but being blocked on a vetting basis. Because you follow, that is the concern that I would have, that there'd be a person. I think we need to bear that, keep that in our mind the whole time. And I think that's the reason that we initially raised. We can't have it mustn't be a blocking mechanism. Sure, if a person is a national security risk with a background or something, but it shouldn't be that by using vetting, we only make sure we've got national security people that do not have the necessary skills on PIA on that other legislation. May I just also ask, we tested the judge in RICA. If we test the Section 46 overriding PIA, which has got top secret documents that can be made accessible to the public, should those documents be refused access and it goes up on a higher level and ends up in the Human Rights Commission, for example, a complaint is lodged with the Human Rights Commission where State Department does not, and National Security Department does not want to surrender those documents in terms of Section 46, where there's a clear case that's in the public interest, and that Human Rights Commission then has to subpoena the state organ, the minister, to come and explain why, and has to see those top secret documents. Now, my understanding is that the Human Rights Commission are not vetted at that level. Is that not another example of members that have to have sight of classified documents? There's a whole range of documents where the override kicks in. So I think that there are examples of officials here, in this case, the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, that has to consider top secret documents that might not have the necessary vetting. But I do appreciate this panel has a broader and looking at these documents on an ongoing basis. And I think that we as opposition need to bear that in mind as well when we consider the concerns that the chair has expressed. And I think we need to further engage. What does vetting exactly mean? At what level? Are DGs across the board vetted? Are public servants vetted? At what level? I appreciate the screening, but I don't have the necessary knowledge of that too at this stage. But I think it is an issue that we can engage further and look at once we start getting the broader context of this panel. Are we reaching agreement of the thresholds of where are we going to on the bill? What concessions are being made from the majority party, which we appreciate. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Maney and then the Honourable Landers.
Thank you, Chair. Again, I mean, I would agree with the Honourable Swart that this is a conversation which will take place probably in the coming weeks, and we don't need to reach finality here. I would just like to sort of pursue my argument about the directing judge. As I understand it, the directing judge is responsible for, as I say, authorising or denying the authorisation of warrants to intercept communications of either individuals or institutions. And presumably the motivation for those warrants must contain, or in many cases must contain, some very sensitive information. And yet the directing judge is not vetted, which I think is correct. But the only reason the directing judge is presumably not vetted is because, and quite correctly, we assume when we appoint the directing judge that he or she is a person whose integrity is beyond question and would comply with a very high standard of conduct. My question is, why can persons of similar integrity not be appointed to this panel? That, I just think, is an argument we should work through.
Honourable
Chair, we agree that this is a matter for engagement, and so I suggest we leave it at that. Just to point out, to make the further point, that the RICA judge is appointed by the Minister of Justice. I'm not sure if it's in consultation or after consultation with the Chief Justice. So as far as that's concerned, that's how that person is appointed. This panel is being appointed using a different process. But as Mr. Swart says, the people on this panel, if we agree to what is contained in your proposal, will be looking at random sampling methods. So they will be dealing with pretty heavy stuff. Unlike the RICA judge, who is a retired judge, doesn't sit 24/7 in that office receiving applications. So there is some difference. But we take the point about the Human Rights Commission. It is a sticky issue. We concede that there may be the perception that a certain individual is being the vetting is being refused for reasons other than what is contained in the Act, assuming that all this goes into the Act. We share that concern, and so let's move forward on that basis, Chair.
Honourable members? Yeah, Honourable Mania, I think that the question of the wicked judge is not a very good example. The human rights thing, I think the commissioner there should be vetted. My understanding is that people at that level are supposed to be vetted. You will recall there has been over the years a lot of complaints, particularly from the DA, that NIA didn't have the capacity to vet all the people they were supposed to vet. And it is precisely because there's a whole range of people like premiers and DGs and commissioners that are supposed to be vetted because of the capacity, and the way NIA has tried to resolve that is by introducing vetting field units. So they would come to your institution, they would train people at your institution to deal with the initial stages of vetting, which is the process that the Honourable Landers raised earlier, is that's the collecting of the information. There are forms to be filled in. There's a whole range of information you have to supply before you go to the next process, which is the interview. So you give them all this information, you fill in the form, then they go and check on all these things, whether you actually have got that money in the bank that you say you have, whether your relations are in fact your relations and your mother and father are in fact your mother and father. So by the time they interview, they question you on these things. Now, what NIA has been doing, they've been training people at the various organs of state to gather that information, because it's just a gathering of information. And they then take the process further after they have that information. And so they are hoping to overcome the backlog, because that process of gathering information is actually a very tedious, drawn-out thing. We've got two members of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence now that have been going through that process now for a few months, just gathering, because sometimes you are not able to supply your certificates and the process gets stopped there. And it can take long, and that is what has slowed NIA down. So you would find now that you might be misled when you get to hear that there are institutions doing their own vetting. It is merely a process that NIA has adopted to assist them in overcoming the backlogs. As for the judge, Honourable Mania, you see, if you went to a policeman today and you said, you know, my neighbour is a big criminal and there are syndicates operating there, they would take an affidavit from you. It would be quite a sensitive affidavit, because you wouldn't want the police to go and show the affidavit to your neighbour and then your neighbour decides to eliminate you. But the question now is, this is sensitive information in the broader context, not in the bill's context, and you would expect the police to behave properly in that context and not rush next door and say, you know, your neighbour's complaining that you are a gangster. It is that type of information that the judge gets. The law enforcement agencies that have the legal obligation or the right to do interceptions would go there with an affidavit. The judge wouldn't know who he's talking about. He'd come and say, you know, Mr. Mania, the judge, his business is not whether this man, whether this is the right name or the wrong name. He looks whether you are complying with the act, whether you are showing that a serious, not a small crime, a serious one. This judge is not there for Mickey Mouse stuff, you know, somebody stole your motor car and now you can't find him and you want the intelligence people to intercept some suspect's telephone communication because he might be the thief. No, you're talking about serious. Everywhere in that RICO Act, it refers to serious crimes. So you come there as a NIA or as a crime intelligence or as a police and you say, you know, there is this thing and we have been tried, we've tried everything and we haven't been able to get into this, but we suspect this chap is busy with serious crimes. Okay, so there's no classification there. I mean, if you want those people to classify the affidavit, it's merely a sensitive affidavit dealing with a sensitive matter. Whether we want those applications to fall in the ambit of the act that it should be classified, that's another matter. You know, maybe the file has been classified at the NIR level, but at the application level, the judge receives an affidavit and he makes a decision on that. Now, you must understand that sometime or another, the whole purpose of the application is that you want to go to court with this if necessary. That's why you do it legally. You can't do it illegally because obviously you wouldn't go to court and say, you know, I intercepted this chap's communication and I found that he's a crook. You're going to have to show that you went through the judge, that it was all, that you had complied with the act. And that is the purpose of the judge, so that you can go to court with the information, and those affidavits will all then become part of the court application. And the evidence that will be led, how you went about it, what was the case that you made up, and so forth and so on. And whether it is the committee's view that that type of thing should be governed here, I don't think it should be, but if you think that stuff is secret enough, that it should be classified when those applications should be classified and then also fall under the ambit of the review committee, I don't think so. But I'm merely answering the Honourable Mania on the fact is that the judge is dealing with a specific thing. Everything that he deals with is basically that. He deals with nothing else. Nobody comes to him and say, do you know that South Africa and Zimbabwe has entered into a secret agreement whereby this and this and this? And what's your opinion on the matter? He's not empowered to look into those things. He deals with applications, and that's all. It's very, very refined, very narrow. And so, the question of his integrity, yes, I mean, you know, these are human beings. But you must remember the vetting process is, it's a dangerous thing because a man that is sound and trustworthy today is not necessarily trustworthy tomorrow. Oh, yes. Well, you must understand, if you place yourself in a vulnerable position, there are people that like to approach you. And you become tempted. And that's the whole basis on which the oversight is based, that people can't be trusted. If you trust people, you know, why? Then you shouldn't. You don't need police. You don't need oversight. The whole basis of oversight is that people can't be trusted. Now, if you want to proceed on the basis that, and I'm not saying that the honorable people that you might have in mind are not going to be trustworthy, but you cannot legislate on the basis that everybody that you are going to nominate and that will become a member of a panel is going to be trustworthy. You know how you can become disappointed in those that you have trusted in the past. Honorable Landers?
Chairperson, can we close this particular matter on the understanding that we're going to come back to it? And that being the case, I ask your indulgence because we want to put before the committee certain proposals with regard to the bill.
Honorable members, then I understand the Honorable Landers, they want some time to consider these things. Is that correct, Honorable Landers? And then you want to look at perhaps how you want to respond. Okay, Honorable Landers, you may proceed.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. The ANC has given very serious and careful consideration to the many concerns expressed. And let me say at the outset that these are concerns expressed by members of the ANC, as well as by civil society. We want to say this morning that we want to change the culture of secrecy. And in considering the provisions of this bill, we need to be sure that decisions taken by state departments and civil servants must be justifiable and they must be accountable. Now, I picked up in the media in a recent post about some confidentiality agreement officials in basic education were required to sign. And this is an example of decisions of state departments being made justifiable and accountable.
We don't have any means of checking, we haven't had, the veracity of that report. We'd like that to be followed up as an aside, because we are disturbed by it. But to come to what I believe to be the more important issues, we believe that, and this is a formal proposal from the ANC, that the scope of application of the bill must be drastically reduced. Insofar as it applies to the authority to classify information. To that end, we would propose the provision of an opt-in clause so that those people who are not in the security services and intelligence structures but are in a situation where they require information to be classified must make application to do so. We've given serious consideration to the question of appeals. So over and above the review panel that we've just finished discussing, we want to propose the inclusion in the appeals process of a retired judge, whether it's the RICA judge as referred to by the Honorable Dean Smuts or another retired judge is something we can talk about. We want to state in very clear terms this morning, Chairperson, that we are concerned about the possible abuse of the provisions of this Act for purposes of hiding corrupt activities. And so we must do everything possible to ensure that we put in the bill provisions that not only penalize stringently any such attempt, but methods that could be used to prevent that. And then, Chairperson, the minimum sentences provisions in the bill we propose be removed. In addition to that, we want to ensure that the bill ensures proportionality in sentences, and we need to give careful consideration to that in the offences clause. And then finally, Chairperson, we have a responsibility as members of Parliament. I take the point that Advocate Enver Daniels, as the head of State Law, Office of State Law Advisors, declared the bill to be constitutional, but the responsibility to ensure that constitutionality is ours. It is not enough for Enver Daniels to sit before the committee and say, I believe it is constitutional. In every single clause in this bill, we have to ensure that it meets that requirement. So, Chairperson, we thought it would be appropriate for us to make this announcement this morning, in addition to our discussions on the review panel. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Are you taking questions, Honourable Honours? You are taking questions. Are these questions, Honourable Members? The Honourable Dean Smith and then the Honourable Swartz.
Chairman, it is a vindication of the parliamentary legislative process during which we go on talking to each other until we hear each other and make a solution. It is a vindication of that process that the ANC takes these positions this morning. It is, of course, also a vindication of our position in as much as we have asked since the first day of the first meeting of the first ad hoc in 2008 that the scope and application must be narrowed. You cannot, for the purposes of classification, make this bill applicable to all organs of state and all spheres of government. It is therefore so much time having since ensued. It is therefore very good news indeed. We are very pleased that you take this position. On the matter of allowing departments outside of the security department to opt in if they do want to classify, there too we are very glad. The only dispute is between Mr. Mania and me. He thinks it was his idea and I think it was my idea. And we won't go and swat up the record, but we are delighted with that. And I think that all South Africans can feel confident that this process is now well on track to produce a law that will not allow the abuse of classification. There are, however, of course, outstanding issues, and the definition of national security will be fundamental to that, and we will yet fight that one out. We are delighted to have the retired judge for appeals. We did indeed suggest the RICA judge, but it's neither here nor there. He just has specialist knowledge. It is a very important component of giving confidence to the public and to citizens, including journalists, to have an independent appeal mechanism. This means that when a person applies for information to be declassified and they are turned down, in that event they can now appeal to a retired judge. And I think this will give not only comfort but confidence. We will certainly be willing to look with you at increased penalties for the abuse of classification. Your review panel will help with that too. We are delighted that you will abandon the minimum sentences, and delighted also with your approach to the constitutionality. There are many ways in which, of course, if we are not ourselves satisfied at the end of the process that we've got a constitutional bill, there are things we can do to test it. But so thank you very much, Chair. I think this is a real progress.
The Honourable Swartz.
Thank you, Chair. I just wish to endorse what the Honourable Smuts has said and to state that these are significant concessions. And again, it does endorse the parliamentary process of listening to one another and to be persuaded. And that is one of the main reasons why I mentioned earlier, let's look at the broad bill when we see all the changes in the concessions that have been made. But there are significant concessions which I think will go a long way to improve the bill, will go a long way to improve the constitutionality of the bill. And I particularly appreciate Honourable Lander's comments on the issue of moving away from a culture of secrecy. We know the background, the apartheid background of that culture of secrecy, and the need that we move away, the bridge to a new South Africa, transparency, accountability, and that state organs must justify their actions. And I think you put that very well, that there would be a justifiability for an opt-in for classification, and that will be on, the onus would be on the state to justify that. And so we welcome that, we support that. We would also just ask that we would look in that, against that background of the uniqueness of South Africa's background and the need to move from a culture of secrecy to openness and transparency, which resulted in the Constitutional Act of Pire, which has that unique override clause, a unique override clause in the public interest, to consider a limited public interest defense during this recess, to look at the implications of that, to consider the Canadian issue, and of course the uniqueness of South Africa's situation. I've not yet found a similar override where you balance harm to national security with the public interests. And it's a balancing act. And therefore I'd ask you just to look into that unique clause and to whether we could find a way of finding a limited public interest defense, which I think would seal it as far as the constitutionality of the bill is concerned. And I did hand to the Mr. Dlomo an issue around that Canadian case where criminal provisions were struck down that infringed the right of freedom of expression in particular journalists. and I'd be pleased to pass that on to you, Mr. Landis, as well, just for your consideration. But just to conclude, this is a significant concession, and I think we are making very good progress, and just to again express our gratitude for the manner, Chair, that we've gone through this process over a lengthy period of time. Yes, we appreciate the pressure that's been brought to bear from civil society, from that we've been able to engage with the compelling arguments, but again, the openness from the majority party to consider significant concessions right from the word go. There have been a number of concessions, and I think we are on the point of finalising a bill that would serve the interests of South Africa and strike the right balance between national security and the right of access to information. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Honourable Landis.
Just one point which I omitted to make. I had noted it in my notes, and I beg your indulgence and apologise to you. The crime of espionage, we've committed to doing away with minimum sentences, but we ask that you look at the crime of espionage as an exception. Throughout the world, the crime of espionage in some countries is viewed as being akin to murder. And so perhaps insofar as that is concerned, we could perhaps make an exception. My own personal view, and I must stress this, Chairperson, this is my personal view. I've not canvassed it with my ANC comrades. I believe South Africa should have a dedicated espionage act, an act of parliament dealing solely with espionage. But that's perhaps for some other time. But as far as this bill is concerned, all the other offences, there's no minimum sentences, but let's have a careful look at espionage and whether we can provide a minimum sentence for that offence. And that will be decided by the courts of law, of course.
The Honourable Swartz.
No, absolutely. The issue of crime of espionage, again, one needs to look, it's a new crime which we are creating, because previously the crime was high treason. So we need to look exactly at as to the elements of that crime. It's very severe, and I think I previously at some stage indicated when we discussed minimum sentences that might be the exception, when there might be a justifiability for minimum sentence for that particular crime. It all depends to what degree the elements of that crime would relate to a member of the public, what the elements are. And I think there's a bit of, and we'd like to look at that first. And again, clearly it relates again to the possibility of a limited public interest defence. And that's a debate for another day. Thank you, Chair.
We don't want to address it now, Chair. We're certainly willing to look at it. I think if we write an act or write it in here, a lot of thought will have to be given to either definition or context. Sometimes these things sit in a terrorist act. And especially if we're going to hang on to the hostile activity offence, there, particularly Mr. Manio has been insisting, and he's absolutely right, that you have to write a definition for prejudice to the Republic. You can't just have a thing called hostile activity. It's a funny thing. In 2008, and I think even now, nobody in the public submissions very much objected to this hostile activity. It's too interesting. People just assume, yeah, well, no, fine. There must be something that constitutes hostile activity. There's 25 years in jail hanging on it. So, but yes, but we don't want to address it now. We want to look at it later.
Yes.
Just on maybe just as I'm just thinking now, the opt-in clause, there might be an avenue that decision might also be subject to appeal or review. We can look into that as well. The decision as to whether a department is included, who takes that decision, and whether that decision is subject to reasons. But I think the opt-in as opposed to all-inclusive is a welcome suggestion, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable members, there appears to be a proposal to get married here. Is there still any use for me?
No.
seems that you, it seems that you people are trying to render me redundant. Perhaps I should adjourn on the understanding that when I come back, you are going to give me a bill which we can take to the house. But keep me informed, honourable members, how far you get with this proposal to get married. Honourable members, the programme. Honourable Honour.
Chairperson, as you know, we've functioned with great difficulty, and I think all the members of this committee have struggled, as you have, Chairperson, to find time to fit in, and it's exacerbated by the fact that the bill before us is extremely complex, complicated. It's you can't just give 2 hours of a morning to it and think you're going to do justice to it. Now, with that in mind, we want to propose, and we hope that members of the DA and the ACDP and whoever else agree to this, dedicating some time in July where the ad hoc committee can sit in a period which is, should be set down for recess, a period of at least 2 weeks. Now, I have scheduled a Justice Committee meeting on Tuesday the 28th to receive briefings on the three bills before us. So that does takes care of next week. I understand the Joint Standing Committee on Defence has a workshop of sorts which will finish on the 4th. And then we have our judicial conference hosted by the Chief Justice. Starts on Thursday the 7th of July and finishes on Sunday the 10th. So with that in mind, Chairperson, we want to put to the committee that we ask you to ask the powers that be for permission to sit the 11th of July, Monday, till the 15th, and then again on the 18th, Monday the 18th, until the 22nd, so that we apply our minds comfortably without worrying about, as in Mr. Ambrosini's case, my Trade and Industry Committee, or as in Mr. Swart's case, I've got to be in finance, as in my case, I have a Justice Portfolio Committee, and the Honourable Dean Smuts and David Mania have exactly the same difficulties as do other members of the ANC. The intention then, Chair, is to give us, in a very relaxed atmosphere, the opportunity to engage. We're doing it sort of, sort of almost ad hoc, stop, go, and I don't know if that's the best way to deal with legislation. And so that is why we are making this proposal, Chairperson.
Honourable Mania, Honourable Swart after that.
Chair, in many respects, I agree with Honourable Landers' diagnosis. The remedy, though, is a problem. In my own case, for much of the period which the Honourable Landers proposes that the committee sit, I will in fact not be able to attend.
Chair, in my case, I am staying on in Johannesburg after our judicial conference and will not be back until the 15th, so that is problem number one. From the 18th onwards, I could be more available, but I don't want to work without Mr. Mania. Steve?
Chair, I appreciate the sentiment, and I think it will be useful. We earlier spoke about towards the end of July. We've got a Magistrates Commission meeting the 21st, but I think from the 18th, that week, I could definitely make myself available from that, the 18th, the 11th to the 15th is a very difficult week for me. So is there not a possibility that we could consider from the 18th and and then the following week, the 25th on. 21st and 22nd. That's 2 days. But I can avail myself the 18th, 19th, 20th. Committees already then? Committees.
The JSCI is going on over this night from the 1st to the 5th. August to the 5th.
So we seem to. Monday to Friday, definitely. 25 to 29. Yeah, even as far as we can that week. 29. It is, but I can always make a plan. We can see.
All right. That's excellent. We will get a lot, and we can work even. It's actually it's very useful to work.
I don't want you to get into these agreements and then the Honourable Abrasini starts. Can I ask you, Honourable Members, to discuss this thing amongst yourselves in the next few days? You all have to be here. What about the Saturday? Somebody was talking about the Saturday.
Let's see how we go that week. The Saturday will be difficult for me, but let's see how we go the week.
I'm merely saying that we don't have to seal the thing. There's understanding those dates. I would like you to run to the Saturday, the 30th, too.
Okay.
Because it seems that the Honourable Dean Smuts thinks that it's a nice day to work. I merely asking that you don't have to finalize it now. You give me these dates by Tuesday or Wednesday. And then you don't have to make phone calls now to people and put them under pressure now where they're going to start looking at calendars. Because I'm sure the Honourable Abrasini would also want to be consulted. Can we then agree that in principle that is the week that we're going to sit in? Subject to final confirmation where you will notify me. Honourable Landers, you will take that task on behalf of the ANC.
Yes.
And can I take the Honourable Swartz on behalf of your alliance partners to notify me by Tuesday or at least Wednesday next week? Because remember, these officials are going to disappear, and we need to make an application. Can that then be what is agreed to?
Honourable members, I don't think there's, if there is anything else that you want to raise, it seems that we have come to the end then of what needs to be done today. If there's no further questions, then the meeting stands adjourned.